from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It's the 27th day of May, 2010. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. In a few moments, Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group will be here to take up the agricultural futures markets in the second part of this first half of the program. Aaron Hager will be along, weed scientist at U of I Extension, to talk about corn herbicides. We'll hear from Pete Levitt, too. He's an agricultural meteorologist. And then in the second half hour of our program, we call that the Farming World. It's available on many of these stations and online at willag.org. Two interviews, one with Joe Persaki from NASS. He's talking a bit about estimating the size of crops in other parts of the world and what he's doing to help other countries figure out how to do that. And then Jim Bauer will join us from Bauer Trading Company to update his work on currencies, in particular the Eurozone. It all happens right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
On this Thursday afternoon, futures finished in the Chicago CME Group like this. July hard red, or rather soft red, at 467 and three quarters in the wheat pit, up 6 cents. September at 485 and a quarter, up 6 and a quarter. And December at 515 and nickel higher. Now the hard red in Kansas City, July 492 and three quarters, up 4 on the day. Corn pit, 373 and a quarter. Settlement price, a penny and three quarters higher. September at 383 and a quarter, up 2 and a quarter. And December futures, 393 and a half, up 2 and three quarters. March contract, 406 and a quarter, up 3. May corn at 414 and three quarters, 3 and one quarter higher. July soybeans, 951 and three quarters, up 13 and three quarters. August, 941 and a half, up 12 cents. And September at 926 and a quarter, up 9 and three quarters. November soybeans, 918 and three quarters, 8 and three quarters higher. And the January futures, 928 and a half, up 8 and three quarters. July bean meal, 276, up 470. July bean oil, 38.18, up 33. June live cattle futures, 91.57 and a half, up 77 and a half cents. The August at 90.77 and a half, up 85. May feeders at 108.55, 7 and a half higher. And the August contract at $108.50, up 20 cents for the day. June lean hog futures at $81.17 and a half, down 47 and a half cents in July at $82.70 per 100 weight. July lean hogs up a dime for the day. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, $74.55 a barrel, up $3.04. June ethanol at $1.61.6. That's a penny and 7 cents higher. Natural gas at 4.30 and 2 cents, up 12 and 3 tenths of a cent. The RBOB up 7 and a tenth at $2.04 and a tenth of a cent. And heating oil or diesel fuel, $2 even, $7.09, or rather 7 and 9 tenths of a cent higher. Gold futures at $1,211.90 on their settlement price, down $1.50. The Dow at 10,187, about 212 points higher at this hour. And the Goldman Sachs up 14.87 at 492.19. Here's what the weather forecast from our own chief meteorologist Ed Keezer looks like. Ed tells me first that this is his very last official forecast as a WILL chief meteorologist. Our thanks for Ed for all of the time and the years he's put in on agriculture. He's truly one of the best in the business, and we will miss him here sorely. So here's what Ed says. Tonight in the north, clear and cooler in central sections, widely scattered showers and thunderstorms early, then clearing and cooler in the south, mostly cloudy, scattered showers, a few thunderstorms. Lows will range from 52 in the north to 62 in the far south. Tomorrow, the north and central sections, mostly sunny, less humid in the south, a mix of clouds, some sunshine, a few scattered showers and thunderstorms near the Ohio River. Highs will range from 70 near Lake Michigan to 85 in the south. The extended forecast, says Mr. Keezer, temperatures will remain a bit above average through most of the upcoming holiday weekend, but will not be as hot as recent days. Highs will mostly be in the upper 70s and the 80s. And lows will be in the 50s to the mid-60s. Humidity levels will drop, too, to more comfortable levels for several days as we head into the Memorial Day weekend. More on the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of this half hour.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from Illinois Public Media. It's a Thursday afternoon. Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois, is with us to take up a look at the agricultural futures markets in Chicago. There was an awful lot of green on the screen today. Why did that happen?
Well, most of it can be attributed to weakness in the dollar, I think, Todd. The other thing I think you can probably contribute some of it to is it's the end of the month. We're going into a three-day weekend, so that has a tendency to see some short covering. Nobody wants to be a big short going into a three-day weekend. We are entering the summer growing season. Weather pattern shifts are possible now as we work our way into June. And then, of course, with the nervousness and outside market activity, you don't have no idea what the international banking crowd may end up with too come Tuesday morning. So I think you've got those two key driving forces that kind of gave us plus signs pretty well across the board.
Can you please walk me through your short-term cycle analysis for corn?
I'm in the kind of in the friendly camp. I think the way I read the formation on corn, I can't give you a good fundamental reason yet, but it all looks to me like the corn market is at least in alignment here to try to stir up some kind of rally. And I'm thinking in the neighborhoods, I know it may sound a little rich, but I'm thinking in the neighborhoods of upwards of 20 cents from here. I think, you know, a couple things that could trigger that is maybe a much deeper correction in the dollar. And I think the price action and the chart formation in the dollar chart suggests that the dollar decline could be much deeper than what we've experienced here, at least more recently. And, of course, the weather models are indicating that there may be some kind of high-pressure ridge begin to develop in the western corn belt. Any kind of activity like this, I think, could spark a pretty good rally. If you look at the corn market, basically since that bearish stocks report, acreage report that we saw there on March 31st, the market has gone sideways. Actually, we're ahead of that. And in this time frame, basically during the month of April, we saw a lot of market advisory services advise farmers to move out old crop inventory. There was a lot of increased movement through this time frame. So that kind of tells me that maybe a lot of this farmer selling pressure has been absorbed in the marketplace now. And if you get yourself some kind of supporting fundamental, you could probably pop this market up a little stronger than what a lot of people think.
What do you think a supporting fundamental might be? Would that be the Eurozone figuring out how to get through the Greece and Italy and whatever else they've got in their
problems?
My
guess is we're just, you know, I feel sorry for the trees because every country is going to have to print so much money that we're going to probably lose half our forest. And I think that's eventually what's going to happen is you're just going to see a worldwide currency dilution by printing, whether you want to call it euros or whether you want to call it U.S. dollars or whatever. So I think they will work their way through that solution through the printing of dollars. And then once that's, and you got to keep in mind that the dollar index is nothing more than an index compared to other currencies. So then our day is going to come here in the U.S. It may be sooner than later, too, as you look at a lot of state budgets that are in shambles, the federal budget's in shambles. Congress, at least at this point, continues to want to pass programs without having them paid for. So I think that the currency thing will work its way out. Therefore, I think it's probably time for the dollar to kind of set back. That may help fuel up at least the commodity complex. If you got more dollars floating around, it's going to take more dollars to buy commodities.
Are you talking about 72, 73, or lower than that?
Well, we got ways to go before we even get into the 70s. We're still in the upper 80s, and we may not necessarily be done with the current run yet. So, but I think ultimately it'll be our turn, and we will see setback in the dollar.
Now tell me about the soybean market, maybe long-term.
Well, soybean market actually is looking pretty good, barring anything bearish tomorrow. You could probably argue that the soybeans are maybe pulling out of a 16-17-week cycle low. You could also maybe read that as a 38-40-week cycle low. If that's the case, then that sets yourself up, at least from a cyclical point of view, to have some pretty good price strength ahead of us as we go into June, July. Again, don't necessarily know what the fundamentals are going to be to kind of let that cycle play out. But at least from a cyclical point of view, the timing is ripe anyway to see a pretty good rally kind of unfold in soybeans. And I think that's the same with corn as well as soybeans. I think if you go back historically and look at prices as of June 1 and then look forward, whether it's the month of June, July, or August, you usually have pretty good price volatility, either up or down. So I think from this point forward, I think we're going to see some pretty good swings in this market as we go through the summer months.
It'd be more fun if it was a demand-led bull run on the front side, I would think, for you and others to watch. Do you think we're short enough of supply, and might that be one of the things that we're actually shorter of supply than beans than first?
Well, we're really not short.
I know.
But on the other hand, we're not real loose either. Mm-hmm. I mean, the July weather is going to have a lot to say with that balance sheet, because you take a 3 or 4 bushel swing in the corn market off of trend line yields, you've got a supply-demand table that's fairly snug. Same thing in soybeans. If you would swing the yield down a couple bushels off a trend line, all of a sudden that doesn't look all that bad. And then, of course, the big guess is coming at us here in another month. What actually did we plant? And then, of course, what the crop ratings look like as of June 30th when those numbers come out.
Mm-hmm. So what have you got a guess on it?
Well, you have to. I mean, it's generally favorable early spring. You know, anybody that wanted to plant corn got it planted. Now here we're struggling a little bit here finishing up soybeans, but by the last couple years' standards, we're early. So it does look like, you know, looking at the forecast, that the soybeans, anybody that wants to plant soybeans are going to get that job done, too, here over the next 5 days or so.
All right. We're heading into wheat harvest at this point. A quick word on that, please.
Well, wheat is all going to be a hard red winter market. I mean, we don't have a big soft red winter harvest coming at us. So that's going to be a little different. But what we're hearing and seeing is that due to the contract specs on the Chicago wheat and variable storage rates and whatnot, you're going to see a lot of hedging of the hard red winter wheat crop into the soft red winter wheat futures contract. So that's going to be something interesting to see how that plays out. When you take a look at seasonalities, on average, soybeans kind of work their way into a June low and begin to kind of turn up. So we are in that window where you could maybe begin to turn up. I don't look for that because the hard red winter wheat crop at the moment is very good shape. It is starting to come off in the southern plains. Harvest is moving northward. But the wheat market, I think a lot of the bearishness could could very well be priced into the market. There's no secret that, you know, we got a nice hard red winter wheat crop coming at us.
All right. Thanks so much, Dan.
Very well.
Dan Zwicker is with ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois, joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon. If you'd like to hear Dan again, you can do that on our website. The address is willag.org, or you can dial this number, 217-333-3434. That's our mobile analyst portal, and we update it with a bit of the numbers from either the opening or the closing market report and some analysis at about 10:15 and 3:15 each and every business day of the year.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Studio now to talk with us just a bit about weed control in corn is Aaron Hager. He's a weed scientist from the University of Illinois Extension and just released a list in the IPM bulletin of some things to remember about corn herbicides. What are they, Mr. Hager?
Several that we mentioned this week in the bulletin. First, of course, would be it's always advisable. We continue to recommend that applicators, whether they be farmer or commercial applicators, scout cornfields prior to making any kind of a herbicide application for many reasons. One of the more important, of course, is to be able to accurately assess the growth stage of the corn crop. Many products that are on commercially available in the marketplace right now can be applied to corn at various growth stages, but virtually all of them have a maximum growth stage beyond which they should not be applied. And without scouting the fields and accurately determining which stage that a particular field is in, it'd be very, very difficult to be able to know for sure if you're within those size limits. Many of the products, as we discussed in last week's issue of the bulletin, have restrictions that are based on either corn height or leaf number. And certainly with some of the challenging conditions that the corn crop has faced, the plants may actually be physiologically older than what their height would suggest. So we certainly encourage applicators to stage corn not just on its height, but also to accurately determine the number of true leaves or leaf collars that are present before making these applications. We talk also about tank mixing products together in post-emergence applications and some of the reasons this might be done. Certainly to broaden the spectrum of control, perhaps even to improve control of species that may be resistant to glyphosate, for example. But even when we do some of these tank mixes, we have to pay attention, of course, to label sizes for the tank mix partner, for example, as well as any of the additive recommendations on either of the product labels when two or more products are put together. Some of these, for example, would allow a particular type of adjuvant or additive if it's used by itself, but may actually prohibit the use of that same adjuvant if it's in tank mix combination with some other products.
Can you take me through growth stages, not by height, but by leaf number, and tell me how to figure out which growth stage I'm in?
Mm-hmm. Most of the labels themselves are not always exactly clear on which leaf method that they're actually using. Some will use simply counting the number of leaves. Others are much more specific and actually say leaf collars. And usually, I think most agronomists would agree that the leaf collar method is probably a better indicator of the actual physiological growth stage. And again, even using leaf collars, it's not always clear according to the label which leaf that they begin with. Many of them will actually count the first leaf that comes out, the rounded leaf, as leaf number one, and then count collars accordingly from there. Simply doing that is a very accurate assessment of the physiology of the corn plant. The other method would simply count leaves and usually end with the leaf in the whorl that's at least 40 to 50% emerged. Now, that leaf would not have a developed collar on it. So your leaf collar method is usually going to be about maybe stage the plant maybe one to two leaves less than what simply counting the drooping leaf method would use.
So there's not a good way to do it and not a standardized way then?
I wouldn't say standardized because, again, some of the labels would simply list restrictions based on height, for example. And then you say, well, how do you measure the height of a corn plant? Because it can vary depending on not necessarily where you begin at, but certainly at what point up on the stalk do you measure to.
Yeah. Do you haul the leaves all the way up and measure from the top, very tip of the leaf?
No, usually, again, that's going to be the leaf that's at least what they refer to sometimes as a droopy leaf method also. And that would be, again, measuring that leaf that's about 40 to 50% out of the whorl up to about the point where it begins to droop over.
And so that would be the height then, mm-hmm. on the arc of the leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What else do we need to go through on herbicides? Anything?
One thing that we would, again, caution people with some of the conditions that the corn crop has had, in general, most of the state has seen certainly adequate, if not surplus, moisture precipitation. So, in essence, we have a pretty good indication that the corn crop right now has a relatively thin cuticle on it. So, any type of post-herbicide that's applied right now, the probability of very rapid herbicide uptake and absorption is going to be fairly large right now. So wouldn't be surprised if we tend to see a little bit more leaf burn, for example, from certain products, especially ones that have a more aggressive adjuvant system in with them than what we would see if the corn had actually gone through some drought stress conditions and had a little thicker cuticle.
And finally, because farmers are getting asked this question, and I know Carl Bradley, our plant pathologist, has been talking about this just a little bit. Have we done any work at the university, this university or that you know of, about including a foliar fungicide within the tank mixes that are being used for herbicides?
Very little at this particular growth stage, no. Matter of fact, I'm fairly confident our program has not done much at this particular V5, V6 growth stage. We have done some at later growth stages of corn, mixing in with certain types of products, especially in the era of glyphosate-resistant corn, where many of these late-season applications have become more common. But to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any trials that we've done, at least not recently.
And then one other note. If you look at the corn crop across the Midwest in mm-hmm. Illinois at this point, really it's probably further along than you'd like herbicide applications to be made.
Yeah, for some products, we're going to be closing that window very, very quickly. And again, that's why we certainly recommend before these applications are made to stage that corn crop, because the good moisture right now, coupled with the very warm temperatures, the corns are growing very, very rapidly. So it's going to exceed many of these labeled maximum growth stages very, very quickly. Literally, one day it could be within label guidelines, and the following day it may have exceeded those label guidelines with some of the warm night temperatures that we're also seeing. So,
and that is Aaron Hager. He's a weed scientist at the University of Illinois and joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon. In just 2 minutes, we'll return when we'll talk with agricultural meteorologist Pete Levitt. If you'd like to hear what Aaron had to say again, visit the Closing Market Report at willag.org. That's willag.org. And don't forget, in the second half of our program, The Farming World, on many of these radio stations today, a couple of interviews, one of them with Jim Bauer of Bauer Trading about the euro and currencies, and the other with Joe Prasocki about estimating the size of crops around the planet. More in a moment.
It's National Grape Popsicle Day. The invention of the popsicle goes to Frank Epperson, who in 1905 mixed some soda, water powder, and water together and left the mixture on the back porch overnight with the stirring stick still in it. That night, the temperature dropped to a record low that froze the mixture solid. 18 years later, in 1923, the Epsicle hit the market in 7 fruit flavors. The name was later changed to the Popsicle. In the first 4 years, Epperson sold more than 60 million ice pops. On this day in agricultural history in 1907, Rachel Louise Carson was born. An American biologist, Carson wrote Silent Spring, The book was concerned with the dangers of environmental pollution, especially DDT. In 1930, Richard G. Drew of St. Paul, Minnesota, patented transparent cellophane adhesive tape. He worked out a deal with 3M to market the tape under the trademark Scotch. In 1933, the first automatic soda fountain dispenser was introduced by Coca-Cola. And in 1941, the U.S. Federal Register published the definition of enriched flour, giving specifications for required amounts it must contain of vitamin B, niacin, and iron. By the way, the effective date of riboflavin as a required ingredient of enriched flour is postponed until April 20th of 1943 because the available supply was inadequate. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. On the phone line with us today for Thursday is Pete Levitt, agricultural meteorologist. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Tell me about the Memorial Day weekend.
Well, it's going to start off pretty well. We have some showers to the south that are drifting off to the southeast. There's still a few showers and thunder showers southeastern Illinois into Indiana, but they're not very dense in coverage, just scattered coverage of these. And it's going to clear behind the system, and it looks like the weekend gets off to a good start with warm temperatures continuing. We'll have temperatures in the 80s right through Sunday and maybe get up close to 90 on Sunday in downstate central Illinois and upper 80s up north, making this a fairly warm end of the month we're looking at. Then we have a front coming along just to make sure we don't enjoy the whole weekend, I suppose. Mm-hmm. There'll be some activity coming across Iowa on Sunday night mostly, and it has just scattered showers, and some of these showers should work its way across Illinois from west to east on Monday. It doesn't look very extensive, but it is a little dampening toward the end of the weekend. Next week, it turns a little cooler for a few days and then warms up later.
All right. And then if you can take a look as we turn May to June at the April and May and maybe the last part of March and what that looked like here in the Midwest and how you would assess it as a start to the growing season?
Well, wetness was one of the features, of course, but it stayed dry long enough to get the crops into the ground. At least the corn went in pretty early under relatively cool conditions. And early planting is probably one of the best correlations with good yields, provided it doesn't go droughty in the summertime. And we don't see any reason to think that will happen. We're shifting from an El Nino into a La Nina pattern, which suggests that we are going to see pretty decent amounts of precipitation during the summer months. And this end of May activity has been probably some of the warmest weather we've seen. Last season, we only had, I think, in the Chicago area, only 8 or 9 days of temperatures in the upper 80s. This year, already we've had 3 days and probably catch one more early next week. So it's getting off to a warmer start after a cool and wet weather at the beginning of the season, and that's boosting crops along. And that's the way you'd like it to be. And we're looking a little more ahead to see that without heat, and we don't think drought in the summertime, it's a good start for a planting season. It's probably a pretty ideal season, and we got by this wet spell well enough to allow most crops to uh, do quite well, except for a little excess moisture in the soft wheat areas of Illinois and Missouri.
Well, thank you so much for that update. We do appreciate it.
Mm-hmm, my pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Pete Leavitt is an agricultural meteorologist, joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Thursday afternoon. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. This is The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason on the phone line today with us for a discussion on a unique topic for him at USDA NASS in Washington, D.C. is Joe Prasocki. Joe, thanks for being back on the show. We do appreciate it. We're going to discuss something kind of interest. You folks not only take care of, in your office, of accounting for acres and number of bushels here in the Midwest as it pertains to field crops and many other things, but you're in the process of trying to teach other nations around the world how to do those types of estimations. And you're in the process of doing it, aren't you?
Right, yeah, because first of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to chat with you today. I mean, it's always an opportunity to talk with you and the people in the listening area of WILL Radio. It's you guys provide a service for the people there in Central Iowa. You provide a service for the folks there in Central Illinois. I was back in my Iowa mind.
Okay, Joe. So Joe, tell me about this. It's pretty interesting. What do you do? I mean, you're going to Mexico. You're going to Argentina. I don't know whether you're actually going there or not, but you're
right.
You're...
Yeah, because we have NASS. You know, as you stated correctly, I mean, NASS is responsible for the acreage yield and production of commodities, grains and such in the United States, as well as livestock inventories, livestock marketings, and that sort of thing in the United States. So it's information. You know, producers can make decisions and such on, say, like on intentions. You know, we had came out and said there was going to be, you know, so many acres of corn, so many acres of soybeans, and then, well, maybe they might change their mind. Weather was pretty good for you guys early on, so maybe people said, well, we might as well just keep seeding corn. You know, it just depends. Now, why would it be advantageous to someone there in Central Illinois, there, maybe in Champaign County, why is it important that NASS, this bunch of statisticians in Washington, D.C., with our field offices, why are we working with foreign entities? I mean, we've got, you know, such as we've got projects going on in Brazil, Armenia, Georgia, Serbia, Nigeria, and Mongolia right now. I mean, those are actual projects on the ground. Why is it important? Well, I know in the last couple weeks, let's think about this, there were discussions about China buying corn, and what did the corn market do in the Midwest?
Rallied.
Up, right?
Yeah.
Rallied. Okay, now the question is, is China buying corn because they need it or for some other reason?
Oh, can you tell us?
Well, that's one of the problems. Okay,
right.
Statistics in China, no one has a very good idea what exactly is going on and what happens. You have these ratchety markets. A farmer cannot plan. They cannot make decisions because I don't know what's going on, or my advisors do not know what's going on because there's not good information coming out of, you know, various countries. I mean, you know, you think about Brazil. I mean, there's guys farming there in Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, raising soybeans. Well, yeah, they're competing against their neighbor across the road about who's the better farmer. You know, how many bushels per acre can they get? Well, that's also the guys down in Brazil. You know, why are we in Brazil? Well, trying to make sure that they have a system that is respected by other entities, such as the United States, so that, you know, there's good information. Well, when you have good information, you have orderly markets, because when you have sketchy information, you get, you know, markets that are just kind of, you know, crazy, you know, up and down and all over the place. So that's kind of what we're, you know, we're doing there a little bit with that. And that's the rationale with it.
Right. It's the rationale with it. So how do you go about, Joe, how do you go about teaching them? I mean,
well,
what do you do?
What's
the protocols?
Well, here's an example. Like this, we had some folks from Argentina in town. We really don't have a project in Argentina right now. However, we had a group of individuals that were from, I would say, the equivalent of their federal House of Representatives, okay? Yeah. And they were in town just asking, you know, what does NASS do? Why do you do it? And such. Because they, you know, Argentina, there's this lack of trust between the government and the producers. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So it's lack of trust between the producers and the government. And even to the fact that last year the Argentinian Minister of Ag fired the person that's roughly my equivalent down there because they didn't like the statistics that were coming out. Okay, so... You know, it's kind of interesting. So you try to explain to the Argentinians, you know, why it's important for orderly markets. So, you know, where do you stand in position with other people that's producing the commodities that you as a nation are? You know, it helps for, you know, global security. Okay, what's the long-range plan for your country? Well, if United States and Brazil are big in soybeans, well, maybe we should be looking at something else as a national policy. And it was kind of interesting because when I explained to them whenever we do our crop production report, because they came in for the briefing, that was for the May crop report, and we were talking to them before, during the lockup area, but before the briefing of the secretary, and I said, you'll notice that when the Secretary of Ag comes in, well, in this case, it was one of the deputy undersecretaries, but anyhow, the representative of the Secretary of Ag came in. The first thing we do is we ask the Secretary of Ag to sign the report. I said, the secretary has no clue what's in the report, but we're asking them to sign the report. I said, could you do that in Argentina? And they said, no, it's impossible. And I says, when you have a statistical system that is, I would say, repeatable and effective and trusted, you know, even though you start out the discussion, there's not much trust, and trusted, you separate the politics from the numbers. And I says, we've got that here. That's what kind of makes ours work. And they were intrigued with that idea. You know, how do you separate that out? Because, you know, because they were concerned about, you know, is this, what's the true numbers? And I said, well, these are the true numbers. You know, so it's an education process. Now, for the case like say in Brazil, we have a project going on down there. I think it's with citrus. You know, how do you measure citrus? What we've done is our international programs office, basically we don't necessarily pay for it. NASS does not pay for it. The American taxpayer doesn't pay for the services. These entities come to us and they have money, either their own funds from their entity, their countries, or there are grants. There are emerging market grants and stuff that are available from the U.S. and the EU and different countries. So sometimes they use grant money. But they come to us and we go through a general discussion of what we do and then we start targeting down. In this case, they wanted to do some sort of objective measurement, meaning how do you measure the size of the citrus crop. And so we go through the generalities up here and then we send people down to Brazil in this case for, you know, a couple weeks at a time, you know, and kind of work with their roughly their equivalents to go through some of this process and start laying out projects. So it's kind of interesting, you know, when you go to these other countries, because, you know, if you think we have, you know, farmers that don't believe, you know, what the government's up to, it's a lot different than these other worlds, these other countries to deal with.
Well, I imagine that when they come to you, that they're asking how you build trust, and they're also asking about the protocols and yep. and how you develop them and maintain them over time, because I would think that the data collection is the most important part of the job, and not only that, but the historical data, so that it can all be used in sort of one fell swoop at times if you need it.
Right. Yeah, that's the key thing. It's like I was down in Brazil. Oh, this was back in 2006, and we were talking about, like grain estimation, soybean crop, basically. You know, how do you estimate the yield of the soybean crop? And it was kind of interesting because they were, I don't know, bragging, or they were discussing, you know, what they do. And he says, yeah, we go to, you know, it's roughly like it's like a position, elected position. It's like the town mayor, or the not the provincial, but small area, you know, like maybe a county leaders,
mm-hmm.
and they would get, okay, what's the soybean yield in your area? And then They go to the next area. What's the soybean yield in your area?
And that's how they collected the data?
That's how they were collecting the information. And then they said, well, then you run into some problems because you have two areas or two counties that are in competition with each other, and you know they're going to jack up their yields. You just say that we're better than the guys next to us. And so that's – and the idea was trying to explain to them, well, you need some sort of – objective or repeatable measure. Are you going directly to producers, or are you going out and laying out field plots and doing measurements of plants and such? And then, you know, they were trying, you know, they were big on this idea of satellites. Well, and we pointed out to them, well, satellites work well to measure area, how much area of soybeans you have, but it's difficult, you know, what's the actual yield because of the way the plants, you know, fruit and stuff on soybeans. And, you know, just go through the whole process, you know, with them. And it takes time, because just like any entity, any person, I mean, change is difficult. And just to educate, you know, people why we do this thing, you know, do it this way, and these are accepted practices in the statistical community. Accepted practices. I mean, these are accepted practices in the statistical community to do surveys and such. But it's a very interesting, you know, part of what NAS does.
Yeah. Well, I have another question about that, because while you folks do the estimations in the United States, the World Outlook Board, which is another entity, when we get these WASDE numbers, we get a couple of them. We get them from you, or the World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates. We get estimates from you, and we get estimates actually from the World Outlook Board, which are supposed to be the estimates from other countries. Why is it that you're teaching or talking to the other countries about estimation and the World Outlook Board is not?
What they do is for, you say you have a list of countries. Here's the countries we believe their statistical systems. Okay, you pick, well, the United States, Canada, South Africa, England. You go through France. You go through the countries, okay? They'll take their numbers, those countries' numbers for, say, crops, acreage yield, and production, as those countries say. Then you have, on the other hand, there's a whole list of countries that the World Board doesn't believe their numbers. Now, you can think of it, okay, why would the World Board not want to help them? Well, the thing is, if we provide the statistical aid to them, to these countries, they can develop a system then that the World Board believes. And then there's less of a resource burden on the World Board and the Foreign Ag Service to estimate for those countries, because they're believing those statistics from those countries directly.
One last question for you, Joe. What data would you like to see that you're collecting to be better, and how do you think that might happen?
You know, if we could do something more to collect information about distillers' grain products, you know, the availability of where they are and such, you know, because there's hardly any information available on that.
But can't you do that? I mean, isn't that possible to get hold of? We know where all the ethanol plants are.
Right. Well, it's possible, but it takes dollars. I mean, that's the issue. It takes resources. Worldwide, it would just be nice. It'd be nice to, you know, be more, my words is upfront with other countries. You know, them, you know, trying to understand why they do things the way they do, you know, when they collect information, and, you know, just to have a better understanding, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of issues, you know, that everyone deals with, but it, you know, if we can nail down a few of them, man, let's just get the statistics out of the way, and then we can worry about other stuff.
Joe, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, not a problem.
Joe Persaki is the Director of Statistics Division at the National Agricultural Statistics Service at USDA in Washington, D.C. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good day.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Well, all this week I've been asking you just what you think of the farming world, and hoping that you respond. And in fact, several of you have. We'd like to hear a bit more from you as well as to whether this is a program that's worthwhile for you and whether it's meeting your needs, what kinds of changes we should make it with it or not make with it, as the case might be. Please do take time now if you can and dial this number. It's a direct line to my mobile number. It's 217, actually, it's my office number, but 217-333-9697. Leave me voicemail about what you think of the program. That's 217-333-9697. Or you can always email me at tgleason@illinois.edu. tgleason@illinois.edu. We truly are interested in what you think about this program we call The Farming World here from Illinois Public Media, whether it's meeting your needs. If not, what we can do to make that happen. Please do give us a call at 217-333-9697 or email me at tgleason@illinois.edu with your thoughts and comments.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Jim Bauer, the president of Bauer Trading Company, is on the line from his Lafayette, Indiana offices. Thanks for being with us, Jim. You've been following currencies quite a little bit. Tell me about the currency market and how it works in the whole of the economic trade around the globe.
I think there was a major mistake or miscalculation by European officials in the Eurozone. Somewhat like our officials here in the United States made a mistake miscalculating the impact of the subprime situation. And what they did, essentially, they let the euro currency go way, way too high. And their economic officials, I guess they thought they were be in a position to maybe quell that enthusiasm for that euro a little bit sooner than they thought, but they didn't. They let it run clear up to about 160 and virtually dismantled their export market to a great degree, or their capability to export. In fact, I was in the Marriott in New York on 7th Avenue here about a year ago, and every time I'd go up the elevator, there'd be a European, 9 out of 10 people would be European, and they'd have 4 or 5 suitcases. And some of them are empty. I said, what are you doing with the empty suitcases? And they said, well, we're just going to buy up clothes, jewelry, watches, furs, shoes, everything they could get their hands on, because the value of the dollar compared to the value of the euro was completely, completely out of line. And they had tremendous buying power. But as we know in the markets, for every action, there's always an equal and opposite reaction. And I think what we're seeing right now is essentially, in kind of simple terms, it's basically just a retracement off of a market that got way, way too high. And now they've got to figure out how to have an orderly decline, and I think that's probably what they're trying to engineer right now. I actually think they want the euro to decline a little bit more in order to pick up the exports, which they actually lost when they let the dollar or euro get too high.
Do you think they'll be able to do it successfully, and how might that happen?
I think the market's on a mission to get them to be more austere in their spending. And then I think behind the scenes, even though they say they want a stronger euro and a stronger currency, I really think behind the scenes they want and they desire a lower valued euro. As you know, here at Bauer Trading, we've been short the euro for quite some time. It's been a pretty dramatic trade. But my overall game plan is just to watch the market action, watch the technical levels, watch what they say and how the market reacts to what they say and do, and then consequently scale down from there. But from a technical standpoint, it looks to me like the euro has a first line of support somewhere around 121.45, a heavier line at 118.35 on the June. If that would be broken, then I'd have to have a complete reanalysis of just where we're really at. But I think overall, in a certain sense, as long as the decline is orderly
and not causing a panic type situation, I think that they'll probably let that euro drift down. I think the situation where intervention by the major countries of the world to help stabilize it would come if the decline became disorderly.
Do you have the chart in front of you, and are you capable of telling me where the euro came on at when it, because it's not been around for very long, and what it looked like over, I guess.
Well, when the euro first came out, it was substantially lower than where it's at now. I mean, it's and then of course you had back in 2000, it was around the 105 mark. Then in around 2001, it got down to actually in the middle 80s.
That's what I
seem
to
remember. Then we had, of course, just a long-term move from about 2002 all the way through 2009. We had a euro that went essentially from about 85 up to about 160. And, of course, since that time, since 2009, we've had a choppy market, but basically kind of a downtrending, sloping down market. And now we're in a position now, it looks like, to test the 200-day moving average somewhere around that 118.35 mark.
So we have a currency that, for all intents and purposes, doubled in value from its low.
Yes. I mean, well, not only did it double, but the way they just kind of looked the other way, and it had almost an arrogant feeling that high currency wasn't going to hurt them. But as we well know, if listeners remember what happened when the dollar got up around 122, our export market got really hurt. And then, of course, we had a gradual decline in the dollar, and the dollar seeped all the way down into the 70s. And then our export market did actually pick up. And I think the market's trying to figure out now, if the dollar starts rising, at what level are our own exports going to start getting hurt a little bit more than what they have been? So far, I haven't seen too much impact on our export market, but certainly the dollar seems to be still a relatively high currency of choice under the current environment. But again, on the surface, I think those European officials are going to say that they support a strong euro, but underneath it, I think they actually want a lower euro.
And you positioned yourself in Bauer Trading to take advantage of that.
Right. Our bias has been for quite some time negative to euro, basically just in what I just described. I just felt it was ridiculous that people can come from one country, come across the Atlantic, fill their suitcases up, go back across, back to their homes in Europe, basically picking up everything at half price. That was an extreme.
Jim Bauer is the president of Bauer Trading Company. If you want to get hold of him, his email address is jim@bauertrading. That's Bower trading.com. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.